Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we're going to look at the recently published scientific paper titled Evidence of Coal Fly Ash, Toxic Chemical Geoengineering in the Troposphere, Consequences for Public Health. It's a new scientific paper by Dr. J. Marvin Herndon. This is another important breakthrough in the ongoing investigative work by many researchers across the globe who are active in creating awareness and ultimately stopping the ongoing atmospheric aerosol operations. Dr. J. Marvin Herndon was a guest on this show 4 years ago to talk about his article in Dot Connector magazine. It's titled The Corruption of Science and relays disturbing evidence of how the National Science Foundation and other institutional structures have created an oppressed environment for scientists that ultimately affects the free exchange of ideas. We'll hear some of that interview, but the focus will be on the scientific paper about the evidence of coal fly ash, toxic chemical geoengineering. The abstract reads, quote, "The widespread, intentional, and increasingly frequent chemical emplacement in the troposphere has gone unidentified and unremarked in the scientific literature for years." The author presents evidence that toxic coal combustion fly ash is the most likely aerosolized particulate sprayed by tanker jets for geoengineering, weather modification, and climate modification purposes, and describes some of the multifold consequences on public health, similar to disposing sodium fluoride into the drinking water, a very expensive waste product to dispose of from the phosphate, aluminum industry, and atomic weapons labs. Experts and doctors say these industries have found it more cost-effective to use human beings as filter machines for their hazardous waste than to properly dispose the toxic compounds, and that's specifically fluoride. Yet to take the coal fly ash from smokestack scrubbers, aerosolize it, and spray it into the troposphere appears to be a massive criminal act. Not in the United States, however. The EPA doesn't list coal fly ash as a toxic substance. Now let's go into this paper. This is part of the abstract. Two methods are employed. Number one, comparison of 8 elements analyzed in the rainwater leached from aerosolized particulates with corresponding elements leached into the water from coal fly ash in published laboratory experiments. Number two, comparison of 4 elements analyzed in dust collected outdoors on a high-efficiency particulate air HEPA filter with corresponding elements analyzed in unleached coal fly ash material. The results show, number one, the assemblage of elements in rainwater and in the corresponding experimental leachate are essentially identical. At a 99% confidence interval, they have identical means and identical variances. Number two, the assemblage of elements in the HEPA dust and in the corresponding average unleached coal fly ash are likewise essentially identical. The consequences on public health are profound, including exposure to a variety of toxic heavy metals, radioactive elements, and neurologically implicated chemically mobile aluminum released by body moisture after inhalation or through transdermal induction. We breathe it in, and we also absorb it through the biggest organ of our body, the skin. We'll go through some of the introduction. The interplay of political, military, and commercial interests during World War II led to the development and grade-scale deployment of a host of herbicides and pesticides, such as DDT. In her 1962 book, Silent Spring, Rachel Carson called attention to unintended consequences of herbicide and pesticide use and launched the modern environmental movement. Half a century later, there is a growing evidence of a grave, new, persistent global environmental health threat, again fomented by the interplay of political, military, and commercial interests. To date, this new threat posed by widespread intentional tropospheric aerosol particulate emplacement has gone unremarked in the scientific literature for more than one decade. Here, based upon original research, the author discloses substantial evidence as to the identification and nature of the specific particulate substance involved and begins to describe the extent of this global public health and environmental threat. Listeners, remember a couple of weeks ago we had on Patrick Roddy discussing specifically the public health impact of these aerosol operations. We didn't go into the coal fly ash material. This paper has been published August of 2015. This is relatively new material. Recently, there have been calls in both the popular and scientific press to begin discussions about the possibility of engaging in future stratospheric geoengineering experiments to counter global warming. Geoengineering, also called weather modification, has been carried out for decades at much lower altitudes in the troposphere. The recent calls for open discussion of climate control or geoengineering tend to obscure the fact that the world's military and civilian sectors have modified atmospheric conditions for many decades, as has been described by science historian James R. Fleming. Some of the early weather modification research resulted in programs such as Project SkyWater. From 1961 to 1988, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation's effort to engineer the rivers of the sky, the U.S. Army's Operation Ranch Hand, 1961 to 1971, in which the herbicide Agent Orange was an infamous part, and its Project Popeye, 1967-1971, used to make mud, not war, over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. These few examples of weather modification, all of them secret at the time they were engaged, show that the weather is, in the words of the military, quote, a force multiplier. In the spring of 2014, the author, Dr. J. Marvin Herndon, began to notice tanker jets quite often producing white trails across the cloudless blue sky over San Diego, California. The aerosol spraying that was happening with increasing frequency was a relatively new phenomenon there. The dry, warm air above San Diego is not conducive to the formation of jet contrails, which are ice condensate. By November 2014, the tanker jets were busy every day crisscrossing the sky, spraying their aerial graffiti. In a matter of minutes, the aerosol trails exiting the tanker jets would start to diffuse, eventually forming cirrus-like clouds that further diffused to form a white haze that scattered sunlight, often including or dimming the sun. I want to stop there and just mention that TV meteorologists know that these weather modification operations are taking place, yet they will still say there will be cirrus clouds, high-level cirrus clouds, when some of them actually do know that these are artificially made. Think about that consistent lie being delivered by meteorologists in the media in general. This paper continues. Aerosol spraying was occasionally so intense as to make the otherwise cloudless blue sky overcast, some areas of sky turning brownish. Sometimes the navigation lights of the tanker jets were visible as they worked at night, their trails obscuring the stars overhead. By dawn, the normally clear blue morning sky already had a milky white haze. Regardless, aerosol spraying often continued throughout the day. The necessity for daily aerosol emplacement stems from the relatively low spraying altitudes in the troposphere, where mixing with air readily occurs, bringing down the aerosolized particulates and exposing humanity and Earth's biota to the fine-grained substance. The author's concern about the daily exposure to ultrafine airborne particulate matter of undisclosed composition and its concomitant effect on the health of his family and public health in general prompted the research reported here. Since the beginning of the 21st century, there have been numerous observations of tanker jet aerosol particulate spraying. Sometimes samples of rainwater and soil and other residue were collected by concerned citizens and sent to commercial certified laboratories to be analyzed. Although without an understanding of what tests should be made, the composition of the aerosolized particulate matter has been tightly held secret. In the face of this unknown, there has been much sincere speculation in books and on the internet, but also disinformation, attempts to convince the public that the particulate trails are nothing more than ice crystals formed from jet exhaust, and to pin on concerned citizens the pejorative moniker, quote, conspiracy theorists. From the variety of observations reported in books and on the internet, one might reasonably conclude that, at least during the early years, various weather modification experiments were undertaken. But as indicated by photographic data and chemical analysis of post-spraying rainwater, one particular methodology was developed that ultimately was observed by the author to be operational on a daily basis in the skies over San Diego, and reportedly is now operational over much of the United States and in a number of foreign countries as well. Beside the observational commonality, post-spraying rainwater was frequently found to contain aluminum and barium, two elements usually not present in naturally occurring rainwater. Sometimes strontium, a third element, was included in the tests and determined to be present. The presence of strontium together with barium suggests that the undisclosed particulate matter is derived from a natural product, because alkaline earth elements, group 2 on the periodic table, behave similarly and are often found together in nature. For example, cement contains calcium and often contains some strontium as well. That bit of insight evoked further considerations related to the potential costs and logistics of annually producing millions of tons of the undisclosed particulate matter and doing so out of public view. Industrial coal burning produces four types of coal combustion residuals, CCRs: fly ash, bottom ash, boiler slag, flue gas desulfurization product, i.e. gypsum. Bottom ash is heavy and settles out. Coal fly ash, on the other hand, is comprised of micron and submicron particles that would go up the smokestack unless captured and stored. Because of its well-known adverse environmental health effects, Western nations now mandate that coal combustion fly ash is to be captured and stored. Representatives of coal-burning utilities and their trade organizations actively promote commercial applications for coal fly ash, which, to name a few, include uses as additives to Portland cement, agricultural soil amendments, replacement for compacted backfills, mine reclamation, melting river ice, and as subsurface for roads. Some applications pose potential environmental health risks in the short term and or in the long term, as coal fly ash is a concentrated repository for many of the trace elements that were trapped in coal during its formation, including but not limited to arsenic, barium, beryllium, boron, cadmium, chromium, cobalt, lead, manganese, mercury, molybdenum, selenium, thallium, thorium, vanadium, uranium. Although seemingly unacknowledged in public accessible reports and in scientific literature as a potential material for geoengineering, coal fly ash is one major global waste product stream with the appropriate grain size distribution for aerosolized tropospheric spraying that is readily available at extremely low cost and with existent processing and transport infrastructure. The author submits this hypothesis. Coal fly ash is most likely the aerosolized particulate spraying in the troposphere by tanker jets for geoengineering, weather modification, and climate modification purposes. The objectives of the research are to provide substantial scientific evidence as to the correctness of the hypothesis, namely, that coal fly ash is the aerosolized particulate sprayed in the troposphere by tanker jets for geoengineering, weather modification, and climate modification purposes, and to reveal some of the adverse public health consequences and the antagonistic consequences on Earth's environment and biota. This part of the paper is titled Experimental Section. Quote, the methodology is twofold. Number one, compare element ratios analyzed in rainwater, which were leached in the atmosphere from aerosolized particulates, with the corresponding element ratios that were extracted from coal fly ash into water in laboratory leaching experiments. Number two, compare the element ratios analyzed in dust collected outdoors on a HEPA filter with corresponding element ratios analyzed in coal fly ash material, One of the reasons coalfly ash is sequestered, usually in lined ponds, is that a variety of toxic chemicals are readily extracted by water, including but not limited to aluminum, arsenic, cadmium, chromium, thallium, lead, mercury, and uranium. Scientists have conducted leaching experiments on coalfly ash samples, but none of the various investigations appear to be as thorough as that of Moreno. They obtained coalfly ash samples from 23 European sources, from Spain, the Netherlands, Italy, and Greece, which they analyzed for 33 chemical elements. They leached 100 grams of each coalfly ash sample with 1 liter of distilled water for 24 hours, and then determined the concentrations of 38 elements in the leachate, which is the water extract from each experiment. Although there were some variations observed in the pre-leach coalfly ash chemical compositions and in the relative proportion of extracted elements in the leachate and variations in the resulting pH, the overall pattern of leachate elements was remarkably consistent among the different fly ash sources. And in this part of the paper, Dr. Marvin Herndon shows a table that summarizes the average values for European coalfly ash pre-leach compositions and the average values of leachate chemical compositions that include those used in the present investigation. With its normally limited natural cloud cover, San Diego is ideal for observing tanker jet dispersal of ultrafine particulates because the city lacks heavy industries and their particulate pollution. It's an ideal environment to ascertain by rainwater measurement the nature of the specific particulates being sprayed, which are leached by rainwater. This author personally collected rainwater samples for chemical analysis and compared those data to corresponding average values of experimental leachate chemical analysis, which, as shown below, provides a firm basis for identifying the particulate substance being emplaced as an aerosol in the troposphere as coalfly ash because of persistent spraying, rainwater devoid of spray contamination was not available. For 3 months during a period of intense aerial spraying in 2011, an individual in Los Angeles, California, captured and analyzed outdoor airborne particulates. The results were posted on the internet. Subsequently, the author obtained the analytical laboratory report. The requested analysis returned results for aluminum, barium, and 12 trace elements, but the meaning of the data was not clear at the time. Comparison of those data with corresponding pre-leach average coalfly ash chemical analysis, as shown below, further reinforces the correctness of identifying the particulate substance as coalfly ash that is being sprayed into the troposphere by tanker jets for geoengineering. Like a fingerprint, the 8-element ratios of the San Diego rainwater extract of the troposphere can place particulate matter match element by element, the laboratory water extract of coalfly ash within the range of observations. Said another way, the tropospheric emplaced matter has the same water leach characteristics as coalfly ash for at least 8 elements, which is indeed strong evidence of the identification of aerosolized substance as coalfly ash. For any indicated element, the difference between the rainwater extract and average experimental coalfly ash element extract is less than the differences observed between the element extracted experimentally from the various coalfly ash sources. Coalfly ash is most likely the aerosolized particulate sprayed in the troposphere by tanker jets for geoengineering, weather modification, and climate modification purposes. Reliable observers have reported tropospheric aerosol emplacement since the late 1990s. In the early phases of the program, one might expect that a variety of substances were tried. At what point was coalfly ash chosen as the preferred substance? In the past, one of the great uncertainties about analyzing post-aerosol rainwater has been which elements to measure. Aluminum was commonly measured, while barium and strontium were measured sometimes. Other chemical elements were rarely measured. As aluminum, barium, and strontium are prominent water extracts of coalfly ash, their presence in the post-aerosol rainwater might be taken as a three-element fingerprint of aerosolized coalfly ash, albeit with much less certainty than the eight-element fingerprint shown in Figure 3. Based upon the three-element fingerprint, with its limited certainty, the year 2002 is the earliest data found to date showing simultaneous measurement of these three elements in the post-aerosol rainwater. Within that certainty limitation, the three-element fingerprint in post-spraying rainwater measurements indicates the global extent of tropospheric aerosol coal ash dispersing. Such measurements have been made in the United States, Canada, Portugal, Germany, Australia, and New Zealand. Further, this list is unlikely to be exhaustive. The global extent of tropospheric coalfly ash emplacement is inferred from rainwater analysis reporting the three elements, aluminum, barium, and strontium, that are prominent in the leachate of laboratory coalfly ash water leach experiments. Off the coast of Southern California, individuals have observed tanker jets dumping massive quantities of particulate matter in relatively short bursts, colloquially called bombs, which disperse significantly before prevailing winds bring the matter to the coastline. One plan under consideration is to use aircraft to capture in flight some of the concentrated material, which would then be analyzed physically and chemically, and as well be subjected to leaching experiments. Long exposure to air pollution particulates, not necessarily coalfly ash, in sizes 2.5 microns, is associated with morbidity and premature mortality. One may therefore reasonably conclude that aerosolized coalfly ash, at least at that size, is detrimental to human health. The ultrafine particles of aerosolized coalfly ash do not remain at tanker jet operational altitudes. They mix with and pollute the air people breathe. Tropospheric aerosol coalfly ash can potentially endanger humans through two primary routes: ingestion of rainwater extract of coalfly ash toxins directly or after concentration by evaporation, and particulate intake through inhalation or through contact with the eyes or skin. In the latter instance, harm to humans can arise from body fluid extraction of coalfly ash toxins, as well as the consequences of tissue contact. Coalfly ash that is PM2.5 is readily entrained in terminal airways and alveoli and retained in the lungs for long periods of time. The small grain size enables it to penetrate and reach deep within the airways, where it can cause inflammation and pulmonary injury. Coalfly ash contains a host of potential leachable toxins, including aluminum, arsenic, barium, beryllium, boron, cadmium, chromium 3, chromium 4, cobalt, lead, manganese, mercury, selenium, strontium, thallium, thorium, and uranium. Coalfly ash has been described as being more radioactive than nuclear waste. Moreover, many of the toxic elements are enriched in the PM2.5 component of coalfly ash. The extent of adverse health consequences from aerosolized coalfly ash depends on a variety of factors, including age, physical condition, individual susceptibility, concentration, and exposure duration. Moreover, some toxic elements from tropospheric spraying of coalfly ash, in addition to direct bodily input by inhalation or transdermal infusion, may be concentrated by processes in nature. Arsenic, for example, one of the coalfly ash toxins, poses the greatest health risk in its inorganic form. Arsenic can be taken up by a variety of organisms and, like mercury, can be passed up the food chain. Arsenic can be involved with hypertension-related cardiovascular disease, cancer, stroke, chronic lower respiratory diseases, and diabetes. Arsenic leached from coalfly ash taken in by pregnant women can cross over the placenta to the fetus. Concentration and exposure duration increase likelihood of this happening. The evidence presented here of deliberate, widespread, and pervasive spraying of coalfly ash into the troposphere, which mixes with the air people breathe, opens new research possibilities into the physiological effects of long-term exposure to a substance that potentially releases multifarious toxins upon exposure to internal body fluids. Those subjects are beyond the scope of the present article. Nevertheless, mention should be made of perhaps the least appreciated coal fly ash, potentially water-extracted toxin, chemically mobile aluminum. Although aluminum is abundant in the Earth's crust, it is highly immobile. Consequently, our planet's biota, including humans, have not developed natural defense mechanisms for exposure to chemically mobile aluminum. Although Monsanto is prepared for that. It is a matter of grave concern that aluminum in a chemically mobile form can be readily extracted from coal fly ash with rainwater, with body fluids. Aluminum is implicated in such neurological diseases as autism spectrum disorder, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, all of which have markedly increased in recent years. Aluminum is thought to impair fertility in men and is also implicated in neurological disorders of bees and other creatures. If, in fact, some instances of neurological diseases are related to weather modification activities during the last two decades involving tropospheric coal fly ash aerosols, then the recent ramp-up in tanker jet spraying, as witnessed by this author in San Diego, will likely cause a sharp spike in their occurrence. Epidemiological investigations of wide-ranging scope, including, for example, childhood and elderly disorders and birth defects, may begin to shed light on the human toll extracted by spraying coal fly ash into the troposphere. Those investigations should especially consider airline flight crews and frequent airline travelers who breathe the air at nearly the same altitude as the spraying. The nearly daily intense aerial spraying over San Diego witnessed by the author is part of a multinational, Western, if not global, program that has been observed for a number of years in the United States, Canada, Europe, Australia, and New Zealand, but never acknowledged publicly by officials. Without public candor, it is difficult to know underlying motivations and the range of specific activities involved. One thing seems certain: the potential damage to public health and environment is likely to be unprecedented in its planetary scope. The process of burning coal concentrates the impurities in coal fly ash, an unnatural anhydrous chemical complex whose environmental health hazards are well known. For decades, individuals and organizations have fought long and hard for regulations requiring sequestration of this hazardous industrial waste product. Since the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, was established in 1988, there has been much interest in global warming, which is perceived as a security threat. Geoengineering offers two basic approaches to the problem of global warming: remove and trap carbon dioxide or block sunlight from reaching the Earth. Trapping carbon dioxide is a difficult, prohibitively expensive, undeveloped technology. Blocking sunlight is almost universally recognized by geoengineers as being relatively inexpensive, easy to implement, and moreover has a precedent in nature. Major volcanic eruptions inject ash into the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere, which may remain suspended for a year or more, dimming the sunlight, momentarily cooling Earth. While academics debate geoengineering as an activity that might potentially be needed for the future, evidence suggests that Western governments' militaries move ahead with a full-scale operational geoengineering program. But instead of mining and milling rock to produce artificial volcanic ash in sufficient volumes to cool the planet, they adopted a low-cost, pragmatic alternative, but one with the consequences far more dire to life on Earth than global warming might ever be, and used coal combustion fly ash. To make matters worse, instead of placing the material high into the stratosphere where there is minimal mixing and the substance might remain suspended for a year or more, they opt to spray coal fly ash into the lower atmosphere of the troposphere, which mixes with the air people breathe and gets rained down to the ground. Aside from the serious potential toxicity ramifications on public health and the Earth's biota that derive directly from aerosolized emplacement of coal fly ash into the troposphere, such pervasive, widespread tanker jet spraying affects weather and the Earth's heat balance in ways that act in opposition to cooling the Earth. Those who reside in locations where natural cloud cover is rare, like San Diego, notice the rapid cooling after the sun goes down, except on cloudy days when the heat is retained. During the daytime, coal fly ash clouds may block sunlight, but at night may retard heat loss from the Earth and act to prevent rainfall and contribute to global warming. Nighttime tanker jet spraying, presumably to hide the activity from public view, further retards heat loss. There is yet another consequence of tropospheric coal ash spraying that is contrary to cooling the Earth and has potentially far-reaching adverse ecological and public health implications. Weather modification and concomitant disruption of habitats and food sources. As reported by NASA, quote, normal rainfall droplet creation involves water vapor condensing on particles in clouds. The droplets eventually coalesce together to form drops large enough to fall to Earth. However, as more and more pollution particles, aerosols, enter a rain cloud, the same amount of water becomes spread out. These smaller water droplets float with the air and are prevented from coalescing and growing large enough for a raindrop. Thus, the cloud yields less rainfall over the course of its lifetime compared to a clean, non-polluted cloud of the same size. In addition to preventing water droplets from coalescing and growing large enough to fall to Earth, coal fly ash, which formed under anhydrous conditions, which hydrate, trapping additional moisture, thus further acting to prevent rainfall. That may cause drought in some areas, floods in others, crop failure, forest die-offs, and adverse ecological impacts, especially in conjunction with the chemically mobile aluminum contamination from coal fly ash. The consequences ultimately may have devastating effects on habitat and reduce human food production. I might add in there, chemicals that build up on the surface are an accelerant for forest fires. Here's the last part of this paper. The original research reported here provides strong evidence for the correctness of the hypothesis. Coal fly ash is most likely the aerosolized particulate sprayed in the troposphere by tanker jets for geoengineering, weather modification, and climate modification purposes. That evidence is based upon the discovery that 1. The assemblage of 8 elements in rainwater and in the corresponding experimental leachate are essentially identical. At a 99% confidence interval, they have identical means and identical variances. 2. The assemblage of 14 elements in the HEPA dust filter and in the corresponding average unleached coal fly ash are likewise essentially identical. Evidence indicates that tropospheric spraying of coal fly ash has been taking place throughout the 21st century on an international scale, with significant ramping up since about 2013. Throughout that period of time, there has been a program of well-orchestrated disinformation, but no public disclosure, no informed consent, and no public health warnings. The profound implications on environmental health, including exposing humans and Earth's other biota to 1. Chemically mobile aluminum, implicated in neurological disorders and botanic demise. Number 2. Exposure to toxic heavy metals and radioactive elements. Number 3. Preventing rainfall with concomitant loss of food production and habitat. And number 4. Possibly contributing to global warming with concomitant Arctic melting. More than a half century ago, Rachel Carson called the world's attention to the unintended consequences of herbicides and pesticides widely employed by agriculture. Instead of turning a blind eye, people everywhere became motivated to stop the worst of this environmental onslaught. Today, we are fully aware of the vast interconnected web of dependencies and symbioses that comprise life on our planet. Earth exists in a state of dynamic biological, chemical, and physical equilibrium whose complexity far exceeds the understanding of contemporary science. The pervasive tropospheric spraying of coal fly ash threatens this equilibrium, whose delicacy or resilience we cannot quantify. Human health is at risk, as is Earth's biota. Are we to remain silent, Or will we exercise our primal right to speak in our own defense as a species and question the sanity of emplacing coal fly ash in Earth's perpetually moving atmosphere? These were some excerpts from the scientific paper published in August of 2015, titled Evidence of Coal Fly Ash, Toxic Chemical Geoengineering in the Troposphere, Consequences for Public Health, by Dr. J. Marvin Herndon. In August of 2011, Dr. J. Marvin Herndon was a guest on the show, and we talked about his article in the Dot Connector magazine titled The Corruption of Science. And let's go now to an excerpt of that interview. Your article titled The Corruption of Science in the latest Dot Connector magazine is very amazing, very impressive. It's a feature article. And what prompted you to write this article?
Well, I was very well trained as a young man in science. And I learned science from the masters who learned it from masters themselves. And so I had a good sense of what science is all about. Science is about truth, discovering the true nature of the earth and universe. But it didn't take me long to find out that there was something bad wrong with science, that people don't tell the truth. And moreover, the system encourages and rewards people who are deceitful in the institutions they serve. And eventually I came to understand how that is. The civilian science wasn't supported in the U.S. very much before World War II. And after World War II, the effort was made to give science a financial support so that it would benefit humanity, benefit people, benefit the economy. And the National Science Foundation was established in 1951 to do that. And when they set up the mechanism, they made mistakes. They set up a way of funding science that brought out the worst in people. And they've been using that, and other agencies inherited this. So for half a century, the U.S. government has been corrupting science. I mean, look, if you want a support for science, you write a proposal to the National Science Foundation, for example. You must say what you want to do, how you want to do it. It has to fit into the bureaucrat's program. And then they send it out to review to your competitors, secret reviews. So people who are competing for the same funds get to say whatever they want to about your proposal, and it's taken as fact.
And you don't even know what they're saying.
They usually will give you a little summary of a few little excerpts, but no, generally you don't know what they're saying. There's really no appeal. You can appeal to the program manager's boss or something. People protect themselves.
If you really land on something very important, challenges some fundamental scientific ideas, you also mentioned that then you could be blacklisted.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, here's what happened. The idea of secret reviews was taken up with all the government agencies. It was taken up with virtually all of the scientific publishers. Hey, a great idea. We'll have your competitors review it in secret. What happened was that scientific papers were taking years to get published, if they were published at all. People don't want their competitors to get credit for something. They might end up getting funding that you should have. So this was getting to be a deplorable state. And so the National Science Foundation in the 1990s did one thing that potentially was brilliant. They funded the development of an author self-posting archive, a computer program where a scientist, when he had a preprint of a paper, even before submitting it to a journal, would post it with this computer, and it would be all over the world for all of his scientific colleagues to see. It was brilliant, without human intervention.
Wow,
but
that's
it
great.
Didn't take long before the developers of that process began human intervention and began blacklisting. And around 2001, this was developed at Los Alamos National Laboratory, And around 2001, the developers, in some sort of a coordinated effort with Cornell University, moved to Cornell. The National Science Foundation gave Cornell University almost $1 million to take over the ownership of that author self-posting archive. And they took it over and began seriously blacklisting people who were selected. I mean, generally, people, hundreds of thousands of papers have been posted on this archive without any human intervention at all. But if somebody contacts the administrators, an insider, and for whatever reason, they want you to be singled out, you're singled out for disparate treatment. The papers you try to post, either they don't post, or they're buried somewhere where your competitors can't even see them or aren't likely to find them. And even if they contradict work that Cornell University is receiving federal funds to conduct, you have to ask yourself, what's wrong with this picture? An institution can operate a system that hides scientific developments.
Let's go back to what you were mentioning about scientific truth is not an opinion.
Oh, it's really not. You can understand, you can make measurements, but that's if you do science well. Science should really flourish and function in a community where there's open discussion and debate. If a person publishes some scientific results, then they should be challenged, or they should be confirmed. They shouldn't be buried.
What is the consequence of these secret reviews?
The consequence is this. In order to be able to make a living doing science, you can't offend anyone. You can't contradict anyone, or they're apt to cut you off at the knees with secret reviews. So the consequence of that has been that people don't challenge existing work. They don't challenge work that's been supported by a government agency, NASA or National Science Foundation. This consensus conformity has taken over science. People are afraid. I mean, it's just like in a totalitarian regime. I mean, when you have secret police in a totalitarian regime, nobody wants to stand out. They'll be singled out for persecution. So you just chant the same chants that everybody else does. And this is what's happened in science. And that's not what science is about at all. Science is about finding out what's wrong with present thinking and correcting it. And this is carried over into textbooks, into schools. And young people are being taught science that's not really science. Much of what they've taught is not correct. But it's sort of the consensus-approved story. And people aren't learning in schools that, hey, you should be challenging science. You should be asking, what's wrong with this? And that's the consequence. That's the serious consequence.
The students of science don't even know the right questions to ask.
They're doing a lot of things that aren't real science at all, like making models based upon assumptions instead of making discoveries. They aren't questioning what's put before them. That's what science is really about. It's about asking, hey, what's wrong with this picture?
I mentioned in the introduction that there was an interesting report in 2009 by Jennifer Washburn, and you probably know about it, Big Oil Goes to College, and examined how ExxonMobil, Chevron, Royal Dutch Shell, and other energy companies have forged multi-year, multi-million-dollar alliances with top universities and scientists to carry out energy-related research. I think that's another example of how scientific direction is being shaped to conform to a particular model.
Any financial input causes this to happen. You saw the whole climate gate debacle with global warming.
Right.
Because people were all on the bandwagon of getting funds to show that global warming is taking place. And boy, the people that said, hey, you know, you're not taking into account changes in the sun or changes in the Earth's energy output. And those people's work was being buried. This has gotten to be a system that is so badly broken that I think that it's virtually beyond repair in its present state. It's a sad state of affairs because this ultimately affects what people learn in schools. It's just part of a bigger picture, a bigger problem of corruption in the business community. It seems to me that we're living at a time when people who are law enforcement officers turn their back, close their eyes, and they don't see and will not listen to allegations of corruption. For example, in June of 2008, I wrote the Attorney General for the state of New York, Andrew M. Cuomo, and requested a formal investigation of allegations of blacklisting, unlawful restraint of trade, and violation of individual civil liberties by the management of the author self-posting archive, arxiv.org. That's what we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The university librarian and the provost of Cornell University, Andrew M. Cuomo, Attorney General for the state of New York, did nothing. I never heard back from them.
Wow.
It's okay to cheat taxpayers, and this is what it all gets down to. You hide and you bury and you suppress work that contradicts work that taxpayers are paying for. This has the net consequence of cheating taxpayers. It's a serious matter because it's not just me. A lot of people, I don't know exactly how many, who have made statements that they are being blacklisted.
Well, this it is critical. And your work, can you describe to listeners some of the scientific theory that you've come up with about the Earth's core and why that's really important right now?
Yes, I've come up with a number of things. One of them, and this goes back like 20 years, I realized that the ingredients were all there for a naturally occurring nuclear reactor at the center of the Earth. And over time, I've shown that this is the best understood method for the production of the Earth's magnetic field. Now, before, people had thought that this was generated in the Earth's fluid core, which is, you know, makes up a mass of about one-third of our planet. In the georeactor, the nuclear reactor at the center of the Earth, it's only one-ten-millionth the mass of the fluid core. So what that means is that changes can take place very rapidly. And along the way, I've shown that the convection that's necessary to produce a magnetic field, mistakes were made, and it can't happen in the Earth's fluid core, not for long periods of time like has been observed for the magnetic field. And so what we're looking at is the possibility of very, very rapid changes in the Earth's magnetic field. And so to bury advances along those lines, because this affects everybody. I mean, if the Earth's magnetic field were to undergo a reversal or to shut down, I mean, we would be bombarded with an incredible solar wind. It would fry the electronics of satellites. It would induce currents into any long conductor, whether it's railroad tracks or power lines, create charges that could reach staggering potentials on surfaces and sharp points, cause electrocutions and fire, just fry the satellites completely.
We're speaking with Dr. Marvin Herndon. He has written an article titled The Corruption of Science in Dot Connector magazine. Very fascinating. But you write about implications that I've never heard of an event like this. Can you continue to describe that?
Well, I will, but let me suggest that there's a link for this paper, as well as a lot of my other work,
mm-hmm.
on the website nuclearplanet.com.
Nuclearplanet.com.
Yes, NUCLEARPLANET.com. It's easy to find this particular article. If you scroll down on the home page, you'll find a picture of me with a piece of blue tape over my mouth.
I saw that.
Suppression of science.
Right.
But so this is serious business. The U.S. government should be interested in real science, not suppressing new ideas. See, real scientists aren't afraid of new ideas because new ideas beget more new ideas, and advances are made. It's the science barbarians who try to hide things, the charlatans, the people who try to cheat and steal, and it's ultimately stealing from taxpayers, since most of the science is supported by the government.
If you have a good scientific model that you point this out in your article, if you have a good scientific model, then newer ideas would easily plug into those models.
When you're on the right track in science, things fall into place naturally. Now, I was just talking about the idea of a nuclear reactor at the center of the Earth.
Right.
Well, very early on, I realized that the helium that's coming out of the Earth is the first solid evidence for the existence of a reactor. Over the past 10 years or so, there's been a very large experiment being done in Japan and in Italy, measuring antineutrinos that come from radioactive decay. These things are such tiny particles, they can literally fly through the Earth. They're hard to detect. Well, only in the last month or so, they came out with a new report, and it's a report that gives strong evidence for the existence of the georeactor. Some 20 terawatts of energy that they estimated from their measurements. Depending on how they calculated it, either 15% or 26% could be attributed to the georeactor. When you're on the right track, things just fall into place naturally. When you're deceiving people and you're deceiving yourself, then you can't make advances. It's like being in a blind alley. You just can't go anywhere. So that's the reason that the truth is so important, because everything in the world is connected logically to something else. I mean, things just don't exist isolated. They're connected to other things. And if you are following correctly the connections, the logical path of connections, you'll be led to more discoveries, to new observations, and to new insights. And this is what science should be all about. It's not about hiding things and cheating people.
Could you continue in your description of the possible pole shift event and the consequences?
Yes. If you understand a little bit about the way a transformer works, a transformer only works if the current, the electrical current, is changing. If you were to put a battery across a transformer, you'd see one spike on the other side of the transformer when you connected the battery, and another spike when you disconnected. Magnetic induction is related to the change in the magnetic field or the current. What happens is if the Earth had no magnetic field and it was a very uniform stream of charged particles passing by, there would be nothing being induced into the georeactor at the center of the Earth. But you do have a magnetic device there. It's mm-hmm. almost like a transformer. It makes its magnetic field. And so changes in the solar wind, the charged particles, will induce currents down into the center of the Earth. And these can destabilize the stable convection that takes place to create the magnetic field. And so when the magnetic field collapses, then these raging fluxes, I mean, we're talking about an ionized charged particles with an effective temperature of 1,000,000 degrees cruising right through the Earth. Normally, the magnetic field deflects it and sweeps it around and past the Earth. But when that magnetic field fails, then charged particles can come in. And you see a little bit in the northern lights when you have a solar storm that sort of overwhelms the Earth's magnetic field a little bit, then you see the effect of the charged particles in the aurora borealis or in the southern aurora australis, these incredible colors streaming through the sky. If the magnetic field didn't exist, you would see these things all the way down to the equator. You'd see the effects of the damage. It would damage electric wires because it would induce currents in it. It would be acting like a generator and induce large currents in power lines. And we know that's the case because occasionally during a solar storm, currents are induced in power lines, and they'll take out transformers and electric power grids. So, I mean, this is a known quantity, and that's only when the magnetic field is only slightly overwhelmed.
Oh, I see. And sometimes, is there a breach in the magnetic field that the solar rays can sort of dip into and affect the Earth?
When you have a solar storm, when you get a more intense burst, can get down into the upper atmosphere. What you're seeing there is nothing like you'd see if we had no magnetic field at all.
I understand. Now, your research into the Earth's core and the relationship to the Earth's magnetic field, you've pointed out that there's, within the iron core, there's another core made up of several elements that allow for the nuclear fission to occur.
If you were to go halfway to the center of the Earth, you'd come to a fluid core, basically an iron-sulfur alloy. It's liquid. Around the center of the Earth, you'd find a solid object that's a little bit smaller than the Moon and about three times as massive, called the inner core. That was discovered in 1936, and I have good reason to think it's made of silicon and nickel. At the very center of that is a concentration of uranium and fission products, nuclear waste, and that is what is called the georeactor. It's a subcore of uranium that's undergoing chain reactions, and it's surrounded by a fluid shell of nuclear waste. This isn't a very big thing. It might be 24 kilometers in diameter, which is just, minuscule from the standpoint of the size of the Earth. You could think of it as the nuclear heart of the Earth, and that's where the geomagnetic field is produced.
Was part of an interview with Dr. J. Marvin Herndon discussing his article, The Corruption of Science. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. For more information and links to the guests, visit InOtherNewsRadio.com.